Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 26th of June, these are our main stories. The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has arrived home in Australia after being freed by a US court in a remote Pacific Ocean territory. The espionage trial of the American journalist Evan Gershkovich has begun in Russia. A former Islamist rebel from Mali has been found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity at the International Criminal Court. Also in this podcast,
the extremes are very dangerous. Once they are in the power, they are there to stay. They will change things so that we won't be able to get them out.
A stark warning about the perceived risks of the far right winning the upcoming French election. The WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, is back on Australian soil at the end of a 14-year-long legal battle over the release of classified US defence documents. Our correspondent Katie Watson was at Canberra Airport when he stepped off the plane.
He's finally made it onto Australian soil. He's there waving to the media and to the supporters who've come here to see him land on Australian soil. This is a big moment. Three cheers for Julian. And he's waving to everybody here as he walks into the airport building. Of course, he's here. His family will be here. It looks like he's heading in. His family who've come to see him, his father, his wife who've come to the airport. And this is a moment that so many people just did not seem, you know, did not think would ever happen. And finally, he is here for his supporters, for the government who've lobbied so hard to see him. And he's now giving a big hug to his wife, Stella.
Well, Stella Assange, flanked by fellow lawyers, later spoke to the awaiting press.
Julian wanted me to sincerely thank everyone. He wanted to be here. But you have to understand what he's been through. He needs time. He needs to recuperate. And this is a process. I ask you, please, to give us space.
Before being allowed to return to Australia, Mr. Assange had pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy in a courtroom on a small Pacific island administered by the United States. Washington had been deeply embarrassed and angry about Mr. Assange for disseminating classified documents showing the American military in a bad light in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our correspondent Jonathan Head was in court on the island of Saipan, and James Copnell asked him how Mr. Assange appeared to be doing.
Well, he seemed sort of quite downbeat, calm, serious. You know, he read along to all the prosecution documents when they were being detailed, the charges against him. He didn't say a lot. I mean, mostly he was asked by the judge repeatedly if he understood the implications of the deal that he'd done with the US, that the rights he'd waived. He simply said yes to all of those very sharply and quickly. There's no doubt in his mind that, you know, the deal stuck. There was only one point at which he defended what he'd done. He explained that when he had leaked those documents, he believed he was covered by the First Amendment of the US Constitution. And that, in fact, that he says that conflicts with the law under which he's been charged, Espionage Act. He thinks that's a problem, but he did accept that the law as it stands, he'd broken it. There was this kind of tacit deal. The prosecution, for their part, detailed just how much interaction there had been between Mr. Assange and the former US soldier, Chelsea Manning, and how much damage that could do to national security. So each side kind of stayed on its own line, but they also clearly were completely comfortable with the idea of a deal. And the judge accepted that. But she was very meticulous. She spent about 2 hours going over all the details of the deal before she was comfortable that she understood it and that both sides understood it. It all relaxed at the very end when she made him stand up to hear the sentence. The sentence was basically, she said, you've done 62 months in a British prison. That's as much as I would give you anyway. So you walk free out of here, a free man. And then at the end, she wished him an early happy birthday and said a happy start to your new life.
It has been an extraordinary saga, really, over well over a decade, bringing in numerous charges, numerous countries, big issues too about freedom of speech versus national security.
I think that's the one that won't be resolved. And it'll be interesting to see what Julian Assange does now. He's gone back to Australia. I mean, obviously, he's got to spend a lot of time with his loved ones and, you know, a lot of thinking to do. But what he stood for is still just as divisive, as indeed is the deal that he struck with the US government. You know, it's been criticised by former Vice President Mike Pence because, you know, there are a lot of people who believe Julian Assange was reckless with the well-being of US soldiers who were exposed in WikiLeaks with national security, and we'll never forgive him for that. There are others who so strongly believe that what he's doing is right and necessary. And remember, some of the things he exposed were awful things the US military did and covered up. So you could definitely argue there was a public interest. That divide still stands, and it won't go away. You know, it almost reflects the world we live in. People have taken very strong sides on Julian Assange. He's an extremely divisive figure.
I'm curious, as others may be too, about the island where this is all taking place. Why there? What's it like?
Well, it is the most incongruous place to see an ending to this saga. You would never have expected it. I mean, I've been to Saipan once before. I mean, it's a beautiful tropical island, but very, very remote. It's right out in the middle of the Pacific. I mean, it did suffer terrible fighting during the Second World War between the US and Japanese troops. But since then, it's become essentially a mecca for Korean and Chinese and Japanese honeymooners, palm trees, you know, warm tropical breezes. Everyone wears bright flowery shirts. It was very odd to see this story finished here, but you know there are reasons for that. It's the most convenient place for Julian Assange to stop on his way back to Australia. But I think he also was determined not to go to the mainland US, to stay as far away from Washington as possible. You know, this is has a Commonwealth status with the United States. It is technically US territory, but it's about as far away as you can get from the sort of centres of US power while still being under the jurisdiction of its courts. And I think that's why it was chosen.
Jonathan Head, and if you want to hear more about that deal that led to the freeing of Julian Assange, listen to The Global Story, available wherever you find your BBC podcasts. Well, as Julian Assange comes to the end of the legal process by pleading guilty, the American journalist Evan Gershkovich has begun his spying trial in Russia. He strongly denies the charges. The Wall Street Journal reporter is in court in Yekaterinburg, 1,500 kilometres east of Moscow. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, is there.
Just before the start of the trial, media were allowed into a courtroom to see him. He was standing in this sort of glass and metal cage that's known as the aquarium in Russian courtrooms. His head was shaven. He was wearing a check shirt and jeans. And he was smiling at the cameras. He looked in good physical shape. But obviously, he's been behind bars for nearly 15 months now in Moscow. He's been brought to Yekaterinburg for the trial. And the trial will take place behind closed doors. And that means that no family members will be allowed in. No US diplomats will be allowed in. The media won't be allowed in. So that adds extra, I think, psychological pressure onto Evan Gershkovich.
And what's he specifically accused of?
So, officially, Russian prosecutors have accused him of espionage. They claim that he had been collecting classified information about a Russian defence enterprise, a Russian tank manufacturer, about 100 miles from Yekaterinburg. Now, Mr. Gershkovich, his employer, the Wall Street Journal, and the US government say that is absolutely not the case. They vehemently reject these accusations and these charges. And the Wall Street Journal has called this a sham trial, a bogus process, which they expect to end in a conviction.
Now, Steve, there's a recent history of Washington and Russia doing legal deals. What kind of likelihood is there of some kind of deal this time?
There has to be an expectation, I think. The thing is that the Russians know perfectly well that when it comes to America trying to get its citizens back from foreign jails, Washington is prepared to do deals. We saw that, for example, at the end of 2022, when Washington agreed to release a convicted Russian arms dealer, Victor Boot, in order to secure the release from a Russian jail of US basketball star Brittany Griner, who had been in a Russian jail on drugs charges. So we know that contacts have been made between the US and Russia over Evan Gershkovich. We don't know what stage they're at, but I think certainly the Wall Street Journal is hoping that at some point there could be some prisoner swap. And President Putin himself has said that he would be open to a prisoner exchange. Now, that raises the question, if they release Evan, who do the Russians want in return? And although the Kremlin leader hasn't named names specifically, he has dropped a very strong hint that the man that Russia wants to see released from a Western jail is Vadim Krasikov. This is a man who's believed to be a Russian agent who's currently serving a life sentence in Germany for murder.
Steve Rosenberg. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has convicted a former Islamist rebel of committing war crimes in Mali. Al-Hassan Mahmoud was part of a group linked to Al-Qaeda that seized control of the city. Its members flogged residents, destroyed ancient shrines, and forced hundreds of women into sexual slavery. Our correspondent Anna Holligan spoke to me from outside the court.
Well, it took the judge around 2 hours to read out just a summary of the judgment. Such was the scale of the atrocities committed during this period. But what's been really interesting during this whole trial is the focus of the prosecution on gender-based persecution. The previous prosecutor wanted to make this really stand out and draw attention to the fact that women and girls are so often the hidden victims in conflict. And yet what we have here in this judgment, the judges have found that Mr. Al-Hassan was guilty by majority, so the majority of judges rather than unanimous, of directing crimes, contributing to them, aiding and abetting the commission of crimes by others in relation to crimes against humanity of torture, outrages upon personal dignity and cruel treatment and passing of sentences without proper judicial guarantees and other inhumane acts and mutilation. However, they found that there wasn't enough evidence to tie him to the extensive sexual crimes committed against women and girls in Mali during this period, in Timbuktu specifically. So the judges said there were many instances of rape and sexual slavery and women and girls being forced into marriages. But he was acquitted of those charges and also acquitted of the war crime of attacking protected objects because, of course, these crimes took place in the historic city of Timbuktu. And during that period, the Islamist rebels attacked sacred tombs and mausoleums. But he was cleared of being involved in those atrocities.
Interesting. So he's not convicted of those specifically gender-related issues, gender
exactly.
persecution. But it's pretty unusual, isn't it, for those kind of issues to be raised at the ICC anyway?
Hugely so. And I think this will be a big disappointment, actually, for the prosecution, because they were quite determined to try to highlight the specific gender-based persecution that women and girls are often subjected to. And insofar as he has been cleared of those atrocities, they have failed to bring sufficient evidence in this case, but it's put it on the map. So it's something that we expect to see in future trials here at the ICC.
Anna Holligan. As we record this podcast, there are just 4 days to go before the first round of the French parliamentary elections. Polls suggest the extreme right-wing National Rally Party is likely to win the largest number of seats and could form the next government for the first time. As one veteran political commentator told the BBC's Hugh Schofield, we are jumping into the unknown. Hugh has been in the Seine-et-Marne department south of Paris, from where he sent this report.
What could be finer than music on a hot summer's day in a historic town square in provincial France? This is Fontainebleau, home once to the Emperor Napoleon. Today, it's natural Macron territory. Like the man, it's prosperous, international, and since 2 weeks ago, deeply worried.
I am Juliette Villegrain.
I've come to see the woman who, till the Assembly was so unexpectedly dissolved, was the local MP. Today she's campaigning again for the Macronite centre, and with a simple message: keep out the extremes.
The extremes are very dangerous. The right wing, the RN, once they are in the power, they are there to stay. They will change things so that we won't be able to get them out. And of course, right now they tell you what you want to hear. In reality, those propositions are not possible.
So What are the risks? I believe that...
For all their efforts, though, the Macronite centre in France is not holding. Things are falling apart. The far right could win in 2 weeks, or there'll be political paralysis. And for the veteran commentator Nicolas Bavaret, either possibility presents risks. A debt crisis, social unrest, political collapse.
It's really a situation where you may have a brutal breakup of the institutions.
Si on va au bout de votre raisonnement, le pays explose ou c'est la guerre civile?
And there was another word on President Macron's lips this week. Guerre civile, civil war.
Civil war is a word that Macron mentioned.
Yes, and I think that it's very dangerous because the fact for him to use this word and to try to save his power, in fact, on fear, this is very dangerous because you know that in a democracy, when you play on fears, then you have hate and then violence. So this dynamic is one of the most dangerous for a democratic country.
So what you're saying is that when President Macron talks about civil war, even as a theoretical possibility, he makes it more possible?
Yes, of course.
Alarmist? It certainly feels it out here in the southern part of the Fontainebleau constituency, where the peace of the deep French countryside seems to mock the scary talk of the towns. But this is prime national rally turf.
I am not hurt when I see a Muslim who prays...
The RN candidate is Ivanka Dimitrova, Bulgarian by birth, so an immigrant herself, but a woman who feels a profound cultural attachment to France and a fear that its distinctiveness is under threat from uncontrolled immigration. People who come here, she says, cannot expect to rule the roost.
But the dominating one must stay dominating.
Are you a dangerous party?
No, I don't think so. No, no, no. Certainly not.
Are you an extremist party?
No, I don't see anything extreme. When you have your family and someone is doing harm to the members of your family, you want to protect them. Are you extremist with this? No. Our family is France. We want to protect our family. That's all.
That report was by Hugh Schofield. Still to come.
Let's go, girls.
I'm a little overwhelmed. I mean, from the minute it was even a possibility, I had to keep it a secret.
Guess who's taking the legend spot at this year's Glastonbury Festival? As the war rages on between Russia and Ukraine, neighbouring countries are thinking carefully about how to prepare for possible conflict. We reported earlier this year that in Finland, which shares a border with Russia, the government is opening 300 new shooting ranges to help citizens test their aim. And now Poland is launching a Holidays with the Army programme, allowing young people to pick up some of the basics for battle. The Polish Foreign Minister, Radek Sikorski, has been telling us how the scheme will work.
Countries have digital reserves, people who are willing to sit at home even in front of their computers and to repel those DDoS attacks. You actually need a lot of people to help with that. But also our young people should get out in the woods and know the basics of medical assistance, of weapons handling. It should be good for them, it should be good for the country, and also good for their future employment prospects. When I was a young man, we had a voluntary service like that. It involved getting a glider license, which, of course, the military then treated as a pool of recruits for fighter pilots. And maybe some of these young people find that they like it, and maybe they'll volunteer for the army proper. That would be excellent.
Well, Israel, too, is struggling with recruiting young people to fight in the ongoing war in Gaza. As we reported yesterday, Israel's Supreme Court ruled that ultra-Orthodox Jewish men must be drafted into military service, ending a long-standing exemption. This decision could be politically explosive, though, especially as Mr. Netanyahu struggles to hold together a right-wing coalition that includes two ultra-Orthodox parties. Victoria Wankunda spoke to Orthodox rabbi, Pesach Friedman from Jerusalem about the reaction of the Orthodox community to the Supreme Court's decision.
Jewish men have tremendous respect and appreciation for the soldiers in the Israeli Defense Forces, always and especially at this time of war. But for 76 years, there's been a recognition that the students studying Torah, which is the core of Jewish tradition, play an important role in preserving Judaism's tradition. Israel is obviously a Jewish state, and there's always been a respect and recognition of that.
So what impact then do you think this mandatory military conscription is going to have on the tradition, on the religion, and the standing that has been for, as you said, for 76 years?
Like you mentioned, it's politically explosive. It's really a political football, and we're quite convinced that no yeshiva student is going to be dragged out of his yeshiva studies to be taken to the military, and the military doesn't truly need those students. 41% of the Israeli public supports the continued deferment of Torah students from the draft, and it's going to continue. This is going to make trouble politically for Netanyahu.
If anybody in the coalition, even Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu himself, were listening to us now, what message would you like to put forward?
I'd like to put forward that Israel right now is in a situation of actually existential threat, war on several fronts, and this is not the time to start making societal upheaval and divisiveness in the Jewish people. And we should preserve our unity rather than bringing up topics like this at this perilous time.
You did mention that you have some support. I believe you said 41%, but some might say that is not quite a lot, considering that there is 59% that might just think, well, why can't they just join and come in and help fight those existential threats that you mentioned?
41% is not the majority, but it's getting rather close. The ultra-Orthodox, as they're called, are really only something like 10 to 12% of the public, but a very large plurality supports it. But furthermore, the religious community actually has the highest levels of volunteerism. Every area of life, whether it be, you know, in the hospitals, or you may have seen religious Jews collecting, unfortunately, the dead bodies of terror victims after October 7th, or even changing a flat tire, it's the religious community that provides those services as actually a tradition of volunteering. But here the court wants to come and intervene actually in our way of life, in our tradition, in the ages which Torah students generally in the rabbinical schools, and we're not going to allow that to happen.
Rabbi Pesach Friedman there. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime has warned that new highly potent synthetic drugs known as nitazenes have led to an increase in overdose deaths in several countries. Bethany Bell reports.
The UNODC report said nitazenes, which are synthetic opioids, were posing lethal risks. It said that in some cases, nitazenes were more potent than fentanyl. In the UK, it said, nitazenes were often mixed into street drugs like heroin and had led to a number of deaths. The report also warned that cocaine production was surging and that global cocaine use was at an all-time high. It noted that increases in cocaine use were particularly steep after the COVID-19 pandemic.
Bethany Bell. Incredibly worrying, that is how health experts have described a new strain of the Mpox virus in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The virus, which used to be called monkeypox, can cause lesions across the whole body. The World Health Organization says nearly 400 people have died as a result of it this year. Our health reporter Philippa Roxby told me why WHO officials are so concerned about the new strain.
They've analysed it from initial cases. They've analysed it in the lab, and they think these mutations look quite dangerous. It looks like it'll make the virus very easy to spread among humans. And they're also seeing very early evidence of these cases along the eastern edge of the DRC. And they can see that it's not only being spread by sexual transmission, they can see that it's also probably being spread by skin-to-skin contact. And that means that a lot more people can be infected. They're seeing it in children who have played together in a playground. They're seeing it in families who live in the same house. And also in health workers who are treating patients who've been infected. So they're seeing it in lots of other people. And that's what's making them worried. Although there's still a lot of investigating to do about how fast it really spreads.
awful for that part of the DRC. But the good news, I suppose, is it's because it's so remote there, it may well not have spread beyond that area.
It's possible, although that also makes it difficult to detect people who are infected. And that is the worry. They think that there could be a lot of hidden cases that they just don't know about. So they've got a figure, they're measuring a figure, but they can see more and more people coming to health clinics in that region every day. And they're worried that people can cross the border. It's very close to the border with Rwanda and Burundi and Uganda. And they're worried that people are crossing that border. And the World Health Organization have said themselves they're worried about international spread. And of course, there's very poor access to vaccines and treatments in those parts of Africa too, because quite frankly, they have a whole lot of other things, health priorities to worry about there. There's a lot of insecurity, conflict, war. It's a very difficult place to cope with any sort of disease.
Philippa Roxby. More than 200,000 people are on the move to the west of England with clean tents and high expectations. The gates at the Glastonbury Festival have opened today. Well, the festival, which started on a farm in 1970, has attracted all the greats and musical royalty over the decades. And this year is no different. On Sunday, Shania Twain will play the so-called Legend Set, performed by a seasoned star following in the steps of Dolly Parton, Kylie Minogue and Lionel Richie. Shania Twain's been speaking to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Let's go, girls.
Long before Taylor Swift, there was another female country singer who incorporated a pop sound into their music and became a phenomenon. Shania Twain's late 90s album, Come On Over, is one of the top 10 global bestsellers of all time. And this weekend, she follows the likes of Lionel Richie, Dolly Parton and Kylie Minogue by playing Glastonbury's Sunday Tea Time Legend slot.
I've been told that that is the slot.
You know Lionel Richie, don't you?
I know Lionel Richie.
Now, he had one of the best days of his life doing it.
So he's the one I should ask. It's surreal to have been invited. I'm a little overwhelmed. I mean, from the minute it was even a possibility, I had to keep it a secret. Then it's just been a flurry of everyone sharing all of their fabulous stories and how exciting it's going to be and bring my wellies, and now I'm thinking about which wellies should I bring. I've got several pairs at home. Should I buy new ones?
You have know, you got rhinestone on your wellies?
I don't. Should I get some with rhinestones?
Okay, so you're Brad Pitt. That don't impress me much.
People who come to watch the Legends, a lot of them will wear fancy dress off the act. So let's go through some of the iconic Shania looks. That don't impress me much. How would you come dressed as in that video, would you say?
Anything in leopard print. Any colour of leopard print. Pink, blue, green. That one's easy. Come on my head, do what I dare.
Man, I feel like a woman. Veil and top hat in the sun, is that going to work?
A top hat would work.
Yeah.
Why not? And why not a top hat that, like, pops up so that it doesn't take up any space when you're not wearing it?
Man, I feel like a woman.
Pick one more. One more Shania outfit you'd like to see there in the crowd.
Denim on denim. That works. That's the Any Man of Mine video, denim on denim. Any man of mine,
better walk the line. A lot of people going to Glastonbury, it's the only time all year they put up their tent. What's your best putting up a tent tip?
You know what? I believe in pop-up tents. Don't be a hero. Don't fight, don't argue. And bring lots of extra socks. Give me the chance to say
that I'm sorry. And Glastonbury is on a farm. I believe you can talk to animals. Explain about this.
I love horses. Mm-hmm. I love all animals. But I'm going to go see if there's a horse around I can borrow.
Would you bring a horse onto the stage?
If it's allowed, I'll do it. I'd love to ride a horse to the stage. We're still together, still going strong.
Still, you're still the one I run to. And finally, what kind of show are you going to deliver in the Legend slot?
I'd love to be able to sing with everyone and be a part of the journey of the crowd. So I'm going to do everything familiar. I want to do the hits. I want to do what they know. Oh, you're still the one I kiss. Good night.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Wilfen and the producer was Rachel Wright. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.